From WXXI News, this is Education Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour goes back to 2600 BC. The Sumerians built the first libraries. At least historians think so. The Sumerians collected clay tablets in temple rooms. Those tablets held cuneiform script, and historians believe they consisted mainly of records. Transaction histories, inventories, might have also included some other writings as well. So, 2600 BC to now, 4,614 years. It's a good run for libraries. We're here to mark the end of them. Or are we? You see, the library is adapting to the digital age, and while a career in library sciences isn't the exact same as it was a generation ago, libraries are still very much with us. We're looking into our future of libraries this hour with Nora Dimmick, who is the Assistant Dean for Information Technology, Research, and Digital Scholarship at the University of Rochester's River Campus Libraries. And you should have seen Nora's face when I first joked that libraries are leaving. You said, no, absolutely not.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for having me on the show.
They're not leaving us, but they are changing.
Yes.
And we're going to be talking about a lot of those things this hour. But first of all, when it comes to libraries, everything has to adapt. What's the biggest change in modern libraries that you're seeing right now?
Well, I think the biggest change is how we're transforming our libraries' practices, librarian practices, our spaces, and our programs to reflect the new paradigms in teaching and learning that we have in higher education, particularly at University of Rochester. Our strategy as librarians and as library scientists is to become an institutional asset for the U of R. And so the students will select the U of R because the library provides something extra and something special. And we want to equip our students with the skills in digital media, technology, entrepreneurial, and research so that they're job ready when they leave U of R.
One of my great memories was when I was in fourth grade. And I will never forget. I don't even think I can forget the row and the stack that it was on in the library of my school as a fourth grader and pulling out two books. Frankenstein Moved In on the Fourth Floor and Dracula Is a Pain in the Neck. Very clever titles.
Yes.
But for a fourth grader, absolutely engrossing mysteries and getting them out of the school library. And now I've got a two-year-old, and I don't know if when he is in school, whether it's in fourth grade looking for those kind of books or whether when he's in university looking for research materials or at work, if he's going to be able to wander through a library and sort of wonder and look around and spend time the way we used to.
Well, I think if the University of Rochester's library is any indication, he'll be in the library. The difference will be that our collections that we highlight and the stacks that he'll walk through will be unique. We'll highlight our special and unique collections, and we don't have to have the same book that every library has, but there'll be space for collaboration. There'll be space for using the library books in new ways, and maybe he'll take that book and he'll read it and he'll think, I wonder if there are 25 other books that mention this. And then he'll go to a big digital corpus, and he'll search across the 25 books, and he'll discover new information. But it'll still start with the book. It'll still start with the book in some fashion, I think.
For our listeners, this is not necessarily a library support group, but I'm so excited to hear that libraries have this great future, and I'd love to hear from you. I am sure we've got listeners who still happily use their community library, whether you're like me, either looking for, I get great courses out of the Pittsford libraries on DVD or CD, or we use the community centers they have with our kids. I'd love to hear how you use your library. Our number is 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free. 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My guest for the hour, Nora Dimmick from the University of Rochester, where libraries are alive and well, and we're going to be talking about some of the really exciting things that are happening there. And you might say, library is exciting. But really, I can't wait to dig into the rare books part of the collection. That's going to be coming in just a moment. But I also want to talk about careers. I have several friends. I used to work for Channel 13 News and had a co-anchor who left television news to become a librarian. And that was maybe 10 years ago now. And what are the careers going to look like, Nora, in the future?
Well, I think it's really exciting because the careers of the future are going to be all around information technology. So librarians are the experts at describing things in such a way that you can find them again, which we started with books. We started with buildings and libraries. You know, you all know the Dewey Decimal and the Library of Congress classification systems. But now we have this overload of information, these humongous stores of data and information coming in and everywhere. Librarians are going to be the experts at helping you find the right information, helping you find trusted information. What is the source of that information? Should you use it? I mean, think about, for example, medical information online. You want to know that that's trusted information. And so we're really good at describing, managing, and I think that a big role for us will be in the preserving of digital information. We think about books. We know how to preserve books. We know how to preserve paper. We're not at a place now that we know how to preserve our digital heritage. And so I think that that's one place that libraries will be, and library scientists will be at the forefront.
You bring up an interesting point about trusting sources. We now have access to information in ways the human race may never have thought possible 100 years ago. How quickly we can access information, all the different sources, et cetera. But especially for students, you do have to be able to trust it. How much does that change the role of a librarian? I mean, I imagine when you started in libraries, things were quite different. And now you have to know what to trust. Even knowing how to trust it or what to trust is a skill, is an important skill to have, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that libraries are a great starting point because we're curating those information materials because we know the best materials. For instance, at the University of Rochester, at the River Campus Libraries, we have subject specialists. They know the best material in that subject area, whether it's linguistics or chemistry or biology or humanities. We understand the discipline. We understand who the scholars are, what the best journals are, what's the trusted information in that field. And we also can help students with what is the writing style in that field? What is the citation style? And how does that discipline treat scholarly communication, if you call it that, or writing?
How do modern librarians feel about Wikipedia?
I think they're half and half. I think Wikipedia is terrific. And I think, you know, students are using Wikipedia. It's a great starting place. You have to look at the citations and maybe follow it. But as a starting place, I think it's got a very good editorial board that really is paying attention.
How often do you have University of Rochester students who have basic questions on trusting sources?
All the time. Students, and actually I had a student in my office. They really want to do well. The students at University of Rochester are very earnest. They want to do really well, and they really value our library and our library services.
I have a box in the house that I would have thrown out, but my wife directed me to keep, and it's old letters. And I confess that some of them are old love letters. But anyway, I grew up at a time where we didn't have email, right? And I was a letter writer. And that ended pretty quickly with the advent of email. I'm not saying no one writes letters, but that is largely gone. And in looking at the University of Rochester's collection of letters, say William Henry Seward's letters, or looking at historical letters that the founders wrote, etc. What I think is so sort of strangely interesting is that we can communicate more quickly than ever, and we can communicate across the globe in a minute. I can send a message to someone in Paris or Turkey or wherever I like. But we're not, I doubt we're going to preserve communication records the way they used to when it was handwritten. So it was more cumbersome in the older days, but yet those records were more preserved. Am I wrong?
I don't think you're wrong, and that goes back to my speaking about the preservation of the digital our digital heritage. I think, and maybe this is just me personally, but I think people are writing more than they ever did. They're not writing letters, but they might be writing blog posts. They might be making YouTubes. I mean, the explosion of what people are putting out there personally is really interesting. And I think it's just evolved. Our communication has just evolved with our channels of media. Is anyone preserving email? I hope so, but I hope it's not. That's a tough one, right? Do you want email preserved? Is it personal communication? Is that your job to preserve your own personal communication? I guess in the past, William Henry Seward saved everything.
And a lot of the people who lived through those times did, didn't they?
Some did and some didn't. There were a lot of letters that we found that said burn this, but he didn't. They kept them. So
there were instructions to burn.
Yeah. A couple letters, yeah.
Is it because the information was sensitive?
It might have been the information was sensitive, but William Henry Seward's wife, Frances, once in a while, she would go on a little rant on paper, mm-hmm. and she kind of was like, didn't want that around, but he kept them. He kept everything.
All right, before we jump into the Seward thing, because unfortunately I'm going to get us way sidetracked because I'm really excited about that. Am I right to be a little sad about the fact that age of hand letter writing is largely gone? I'm a little sad about that.
Yeah, I think that's okay. That's valid. That's valid.
Because I don't think we're ever going back there.
No.
Do you? We're probably never going to have communication that is largely done by hand anymore. And even though we can do it digitally or via computer or text message, it's much shorter, more clipped, the language less emphasized. And I'm a little sad about that.
What about Brooklyn? I'd imagine if anyone could revive letter writing, it would happen in Brooklyn or Portland.
Portland, I could see. I could see this countercultural
right?
move. I could
right?
see it in
a
Portland.
Countercultural movement to bring back the letter. That could be, your life's work.
But isn't that a little sad for my son that he's going to have, he'll never, and my handwriting, by the way, is kind of gone to hell, I have to admit. Mm-hmm. My handwriting's awful because I don't write by hand very much anymore.
That's true.
And
that's
do kids true. Even learn cursive?
Mine didn't.
Yeah, and I suspect a lot of kids aren't learning cursive. I asked at the beginning of the hour, and I actually don't know the answer. Do kids learn the Dewey Decimal System now?
Well, I'm a Library of Congress gal at the University of Rochester, but probably. I still have school libraries, and we still have public libraries, and I would hope so. The students that come into U of R as freshmen, we have to teach them LC call numbers because they only know Dewey, so they must still be teaching Dewey.
All right, that's enough of my nostalgic sadness seeping into the program. I do love language and letter writing, but I can set that aside. We're talking about the future of libraries, and as you can see, there's so many different tentacles that come with this. Nora Dimmick is my guest for the hour, the Assistant Dean for Information Technology, Research, and Digital Scholarship at the University of Rochester's River Campus Libraries. And we started talking about William Henry Seward. A little bit of background on that, Nora, for people who aren't aware. Obviously, William Henry Seward was from our area, Auburn, mm-hmm. but now University of Rochester is in possession of just how much?
Over 100,000 pieces of information,
Absolutely
letters,
amazing.
Manuscripts,
yeah.
diaries, photographs, really an extraordinary collection.
And how did you end up in possession?
The Seward family gifted it to the University of Rochester. I think the first collection came over in 1962. And we had a professor there who was writing a book on William Henry Seward back then, mm-hmm. Van Dusen.
When you look at the actual letters, mm-hmm. not reprints, et cetera, and not just reading them online of what they said, what's it like to look at those and just sort of see them in their physical form?
Well, that's the beauty of it. You're touching something that they touched. You're really reenacting with the material object. I'm the film studies librarian. I feel the same way about film. I still have cans of film in my office. I have
reel-to-reels
of film. Yeah, with 16mm film on it. The materiality of it. It's a tactile and it's a visceral kind of thing. But the challenge for us then is to sit with students in the classroom, and I work with Professor Tom Slaughter and I work with Lori Burrell, who's our manuscripts librarian, on the Seward Family Papers Project. And we have a whole crew of graduate students and undergraduates in the library that are working with this material. They're digitizing it. And then the challenge that I have is we sit down and we think about, okay, so how do we translate that to a digital object and a digital project that retains some of that intellectual right? Specialness. It's not just a website where we're sticking something up there. It has to be more than that. And how do we create digital tools, and how do we put those little Easter eggs in that project? We call that scholarly encoding, that makes it more than just a website.
This is where I think modern libraries and what the University of Rochester is doing is so vital, because there are rare book collections and letter collections in libraries. And two of the most enjoyable interviews I've done this year were, the first was with Walter Stahl, who wrote the book Seward, largely drawing upon the University of Rochester's collection. And then it was a week ago, Professor Thomas Slaughter and his new book about independence.
Okay.
Just an absolutely fascinating look at the seeds of American independence that were sown long before the 1770s, essentially 150 years before. And that kind of scholarship only comes when there is extensive research and the availability. And you can't let these materials go away. That's why I worry about the modern materials, because we've collected those letters and they are sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned burning letters. I had read that George Washington's wife burned a lot of his letters. I don't know if I'm speaking out of school on that, but you know, occasionally you hear that somebody lost a large cache of their correspondence. And I don't know if we'll keep correspondence the same way, even though it's easier to keep it than ever. So that's why I think what is happening is so important when it comes to either the Seward letters or Abraham Lincoln's letters or anybody who was sort of that stature. So with Walter Stahl, he comes to the University of Rochester writing this book. How do you start even sorting through thousands of letters? I mean, it's real. And by the way, Seward's handwriting was not that good, was it?
No.
I mean, I haven't seen if University of Rochester has the actual letter and then the best guess as to what the heck it says, or is he on his own to sort of sort through? How does that process work?
Well, we have a group of students that are transcribing the letters, and some become experts at different penmanship.
Wow.
But Tom Slaughter, Professor Slaughter, has to, like, almost teach a class in penmanship because,
yeah,
like you said, cursive is going away. And so that's one of the first challenges. Another challenge is, right, how do you sort something like that? How do you describe that? And that's where librarians bring their expertise. We have been doing it since the advent of archives. It's part of our core program of our skill set.
Absolutely vital. I was amazed looking at Seward's letters, and I thought, if it is so cumbersome at the time, you've got to hand write letters. It could be days before they reach their destination. You'd think they would take care to make them legible, wouldn't you, Nora?
Back then, I think that was legible.
It was more
to
legible.
Them,
okay.
You know? I mean, you know,
maybe
F's,
my modern standard of legibility, right, has changed. Yeah.
Right. The F's and the S's looked the same. There was different kinds of penmanship back then, and I think that's what the challenge might be. But we have some reference books in the library that can help with that.
How difficult is it to carefully preserve just the actual physical structure of old letters? What do you need to do to make sure that they are carefully saved?
Well, they have to be housed in acid-free boxes. They have to be housed in an environment that's humidity and temperature controlled. There's a lot to it.
There's no way to eventually prevent breakdown, right? It's just a matter of how long can we make these things last as long as possible, or maybe you can. Maybe those conditions are right for preserving them sort of in perpetuity.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not really an expert in that, but I would think that we also have the digital record, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the beauty of that is if something were to happen, knock on wood, we wouldn't want anything to happen, but if something were to happen, we also have a digital record. So the digital can help us preserve our heritage, our physical heritage.
And this part of the conversation is just a reminder that when we talk about jobs into the future in library sciences, it requires a wider background and skill set than people may realize. You agree with that?
Yes, I totally agree. Much more technology now, much more savvy around databases and the electronic information architecture.
When I was in school, I recall actual authors showing up to our school. When I was in elementary school, and an author, a fiction writer, would come, and it would be a big event, and they would read from their books, and then their books would be in the library, etc. Does that happen, to your knowledge?
All the time.
It still does.
Oh, yeah. All the
time.
See,
look how out of touch I am.
Come to U of R. Come to Rush Rees. We have several
series. I certainly Rush Rees has done really interesting things, and I'm more sort of tapped into the more scholarly or the nonfiction, the biographical stuff, the historical stuff. But kids who are growing up in elementary school, do you think are they still having exposure in that way?
Well, and my children went to Children's School of Rochester, number 15 school, and Linda Sue Park came at least once a year, and some other prominent Rochester authors came, and they signed books and read to the kids. So I bet you that's happening in all of the students.
I love that, and I think that has a huge impact on kids reading for the rest of their lives, don't you?
I do. I absolutely do. I think that you can give your child no better gift than to teach them how to sit on a summer day and read a book under a tree and to just escape into another world.
Well, when my son was born, you know, it's interesting as a parent, especially when it's your first child, you start trying to figure out everything all at once. How am I going to make sure he loves reading? How am I going to make sure that he's a good writer? You know, and he's four weeks old, and I'm looking at this thing going, he's not reading yet. Why is he not reading? You know, but the best advice I've heard so far is that if you want him to read, don't just read to him. Read. Let him see you reading. Uh-huh. And, you know, so I go back and I think about library days. I remember I can still remember just about every librarian I had by name growing up in the schools, and they modeled all of them. So I hope that that's continuing. We're going to take the shortest break in radio, and we're going to come back, and we're going to hear from the head of a company that deals with libraries in many, many ways. And we're going to look at preservation. We're going to look at what is the Library of Congress doing. There's all kinds of things that are in play here as we look at the future of our libraries, and then we'll get some of your comments we're seeing on Twitter and online. So we will be exploring all of that when we come right back here. It is Education Friday on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, my guest Nora Dimmick from the University of Rochester on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, West Irondequoit Superintendent Jeff Crane joins me for the hour. He's here to explain his district's cuts, the hard choices they had to make when their budget failed to pass a second time. From teaching jobs to middle school sports to field trips, we look at what a district does when voters say no. That's next hour on Education Friday on Connections.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Corning Glass Museum, featuring two exhibitions of Art Nouveau and Art Deco works by French artist and designer René Lalique, open 7 days a week in Corning, New York. Details at cmog.org.
I'm Evan Dawson. Welcome back to Connections on Education Friday. And as we've been talking about the future of libraries, I want to share a conversation I had this morning with Jay Fairfield. He's the CEO of the HF Group. That's a diversified business that they deal in library binding, preservation, digitization, and specialty services. And as you might imagine, that business has had to change in many ways. We got a good chance to hear about the future of libraries, the way the bookbinding industry plays into this, and where all of this shifting is going. This is our conversation with Jay Fairfield.
Talk about libraries, you need to separate the public library market from the university, academic, government library type institutions. The public libraries, they really do have a role in the communities, and even with the change in the content that they provide all the patrons from a paper-based product to all sorts of other media, including digital content now, they're still really relevant and have a place in the local community as a social center and a place to get information. And I don't think that's really going to change. The academic world has definitely shifted in its scope and its purpose. And I would say in the last 10 years especially, the focus on providing digital content to its patrons has been all-consuming. And you're talking about professors, faculty, not just students themselves, and all the researchers that are a part of the, the academic scene. So it's really been pretty dramatic shift on the academic side.
What kind of shift or change in workload has your company had as a result of that?
Well, for a company like ours that has had most of its roots in a paper-based services, binding, conservation, treatment of book and paper and photographic collections and so forth, we've had to change along with the way libraries are changing, and that includes some digital component. We're a digital printer now, so we receive files from customers, sometimes libraries, and print those files, bind them, and return them to the customer. We also are doing a fair amount of digitizing and reformatting of materials so that older paper-based content can be converted and made available over the web. And we do book and paper and photographic digitization services as well. So, yes, it's definitely had an impact.
But you're still doing some binding, right? We're not totally extinct on that side of the business, I hope.
No, we're really not. There's still a need for some of the original core library services, including a binder like ourselves. It's just much less than it used to be. Probably the best example of what's declined and why would be the journal or the serial segment of the market, because libraries for many years were subscribing and collecting, making available thousands of titles of scholarly journals to their faculty and students and so forth. And I would guess these days probably 75% of most of the journals that universities purchase or subscribe to are in digital form only. They're not available in paper anymore.
When you talk to, say, attorneys about library jobs, I mean, obviously there are legal libraries that require all kinds of staffing and people to handle information, but what used to be sort of the old traditional library jobs have become data specialists and information specialists, people who can collate information and know how to conduct research, et cetera. Is that the future of library jobs in large part? What would you say to people who are considering careers in library sciences that obviously that is a field that is changing?
I'm not sure that I'm qualified to give advice about the profession itself, Evan, but what I can tell you we see is the library science schools that are out there have a very heavy emphasis these days on the digital side of the profession. And in some ways, there's almost an IT type of requirement and approach, because in order to be proficient with the digital technologies these days, you really have to know your stuff with regard to the a technology that is available now to host it all. And so in some ways, the traditional library sciences profession is morphing a bit into library sciences / IT type profession. I think it's pretty natural.
When you are reading for pleasure, are you reading on a hard copy of a book, or are you using e-books these days?
I don't have an e-reader device, but it's not a conscientious objector position on my part. I still like to read from books, but I know a lot of people who have both, and I know I have several friends who read almost everything on some type of an e-reader device, and it's a very natural, understandable transformation for folks as the technology gets better and easier to transport, handle, and basically read from. And as generations move from less techie to very, very comfortable with the technology, you're going to see more and more of the content really being absorbed via the digital format. I'd love to say, we're going to see a little bounce back, even if it's good for our business, but I suspect that would be unrealistic.
That's Jay Fairfield, the CEO of the HF Group, and same question for you, Nora. When you're reading hard books or do you have an e-book or an e-reader?
You bet I do.
See, Jay doesn't, and I actually pumped my fist. I said, yes, I'm sort of a romantic in that way too, but are you reading more on hard copies these days or e-books?
I still am heavily dependent on hard copies, but you can't argue with the e-reader. You can take 10 books with you on vacation, and they're a lot lighter when you're traveling.
logical. Now, Jay touched on careers as well. We've been talking about that. And here's a comment from Tom on Twitter. Tom says, my daughter went into library sciences. I'm concerned she needs more of a background in IT than she has. What would you say to something like that, Nora?
Well, I think that people have to steward their own careers. And if there's roles for everyone in librarianship. There are still children's librarians that are still doing the itsy bitsy spider and doing story hour. There's all kinds of librarians, and there's a role for just about everyone. You should be comfortable with the computer. You should know your way around, word processing. But I think that you've got to follow your heart when it comes to your career.
What kind of skill set requirements were there when you first got into the business?
When I first got into the business? Well, I think that you needed to have a bachelor's degree, and mine is in engineering, so that's kind of wide open. And it's also wide open, you could become a school librarian. They call that a school media specialist. You could become an academic librarian. You could become a law librarian. So you kind of find your track and whatever your skill set is really good at. Some people are really, really good at managing information and becoming, there's a lot of people who are attracted to that indexing and cataloging. They like the regular. I'm too free form for that. I like working with people.
You like working with people.
Mm-hmm.
But, and yet, libraries are known as sort of a place of solitude. And that was another thing that I wondered if it's changed. And yet here I found, right in the University of Rochester, from your own materials, and I'm going to read from this because, again, I'm bolstered by reading stuff like this. Through its doors, the library is an agora, a gathering place for collaborative activities, experiential learning, research, and, when needed, solitude and reflection. That hasn't changed.
No, absolutely not. It hasn't changed. Our expertise has changed. I will speak to, there's more and new roles in the library, and librarians are practicing. We do have a data librarian, and she can advise faculty and graduate students on best practices for the curation and preservation of research data. We also have a GIS research specialist, and he's working with Professor Mike Jarvis in the history department, and his undergraduate students, and they're recreating St. George's Bermuda in 3D. So the students are right down in Bermuda right now gathering archaeological data. They're working with historic maps and shipping records and house inventories. And, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You'll be able to walk through St. George's Bermuda in 1865. And in the future, our vision is that you'll be able to interact with slaves. You'll be able to interact with the people that lived there.
Wow.
Right.
Want to get to some more of the questions that have come online. Mark is asking if you could talk more about source verification, that you touched on it earlier, but Mark is concerned that students these days are too easily trusting of what they can find in a Google search. So tell me about an approach to source verification.
So everybody kind of, the way we approach it now is when I teach it to students, I think everybody kind of has their own way that they discover information. But there are ways that are kind of better, that are a little bit more trusted. Google's great, but Google Scholar's better.
All right, hold on. Just back up for one second. I will confess I have never used Google Scholar.
Okay, so Google Scholar is just scholarly content. It's going to have Google Books in it. But it's curated somewhat. So it's drawing from a more reliable information pool.
Okay.
Then, of course, we teach them, if you're not sure, ask a librarian, right? Look for that .edu on the end of the URL to make sure that you're in a university website. .com, it's going to depend, right? Clearly, if it's the Journal of the American Medical Association, then you can probably trust that. But kind of, we teach people how to kind of look for those markers of credentialing or prestige or, you know, just to be a little bit more discerning.
And this, you mentioned the notion of if you have questions, if you're concerned about a source, ask a librarian.
Yes.
This flies in the face that Kelly is saying on Twitter, aren't all of these jobs going to be automated in the near future? And, you know, you can't ask something. Asking an actual person
right.
flies in the face of that. But I think it's a fair question in that You know, we had a conversation earlier this week about artificial intelligence and the way things are moving in terms of mechanization of many jobs and taking the human role out of a lot of it. Is that happening in library settings?
No. In fact, I think it's really going the opposite. We're taking our reference librarians off the reference desk so that they can sit down and really support researchers and students in the whole life cycle of their information needs. So whereas before you'd come up to the desk, you had a question, your question might not have been what your problem was that you needed to solve. So now you would make an appointment. A lot of the time I spend now is I listen to people. I listen to their research and I think, what kind of information needs do you have? So that's how some of these projects evolved with like Professor Slaughter and with Professor Jarvis and then the Bragdon Train Station project that we're working on. Those were just listening to Professor Saab talking about teaching students in architecture and needing new tools and new ways for students to think about how architecture drawings are incorporated into buildings. And so now we have this 3D train station project.
Yeah, it's Professor, is it Joan Saab? Yeah, she was on this program last month, and she talked about that program to create this digital, it's a digital recreation of the train station that was raised in the 1960s, and a lot of folks like me have very little understanding of what it was actually here. And so we have this conversation, and this is in the nascent stages, kind of, in the, but it's going to end up being this, I would say, kind of a multimedia project.
Yes.
And in this conversation with Joan, I'm thinking, this is what modern libraries are doing. In a sense, they are historians for their communities.
Yes.
Are there other projects like this train station that we're going to see, or that you suspect we could see, or that you are not allowed to tell me, but you'd like to break some news on?
I suspect you're going to see more and more, right? And I think that what we want to do is we want to create this nexus of information where students and faculty are coming together. We're creating new knowledge in new formats, right? We have these beautiful spaces. We have these iconic and beautiful spaces, but we will also have new spaces that are really technology rich, where you can walk into immersive environments and visualize things on a much, much grander scale.
And what a great tool of education for kids that is. You talk about bringing things to life. If you missed the program with Professor Saab a month ago, can you give us a quick update or a description of that? We had a remarkable amount of feedback on the train station project. People are really into that.
Yeah. I just think it's such a great project because the train station was torn down in 1967. And so what we have is we have the drawings, the architectural drawings. We have some artifacts, but what we really also have is oral histories. So we're recreating from people's memories in a lot of ways, and how do we translate that into a digital project that, again, is value-added? It isn't just this multimodal flat, here's a drawing, here's a 3D, but how does it become more by adding people's memories, and what do people save? What kind of meaning do they add to that? And so Professor Joan Rubin in history is also a collaborator on that. And our librarian, our rare books librarian, Andrea Reitmeier, she's a Bragdon expert. So she brings this wealth of information. We have Bragdon's letters. We have his sister's diaries. We just have so much to add to this project.
Sometimes do you end up with those materials, letters or diaries, simply because you ask the community for it, that these things are out there, and when people find out that you're looking for that, they're willing to share those with you? I mean, is it as simple as that sometimes?
Yes.
Because those are very sensitive materials for a lot of families, very, very emotional materials.
That's true. That's true. But how wonderful to have them preserved and take their place where they can take part in a larger arena than someone's attic or someone's dresser drawer. And I think that projects like this also spur people to become what we call armchair archivists, right? So now everybody is kind of thinking about, wow, my grandmother's letters, I can use my computer, I can create a digital project, and at grandma's 80th birthday party, I have this big digital project that incorporates her history. So we're all kind of becoming archivists. It's cool.
I want to get a couple questions in from a regular listener who's a friend, and he's a bit of a curmudgeon. His name's Bill, and Bill wants to know a couple of things. Number one, if so much is available online and digitally, why do we need physical structure libraries, especially if they're accessing our tax dollars? Now, that's a whole other discussion. We're not going to spend too much time there. But how would you respond to that question, first of all?
Well, I would say that let me think about this for 1 minute, right? I think that we need physical libraries because we're the intellectual crossroad. Everybody can come in our door. No matter what discipline you're in at University of Rochester, the library isn't the physics library. It isn't the history department. It belongs to all of you of ours. So there's that same as the public library. There's that democracy, that level playing field. Everybody gets to come in that building, and we have the expertise and the technology to share with people who don't have the means.
And by the way, a quick aside, here's Marcus sending me an email saying, my mother isn't online and absolutely still relies on the library. And so, again, there's parts of our community that isn't as connected to technology. And I know that as we go throughout time that getting online is just going to be part of life, but there's still plenty of people who rely on the physical structures.
Absolutely.
Fair to say. But back to Bill's other questions, and this is, I know I'm opening up a can of worms, but it's fair enough. If you're just joining us, we've for the hour, we've been covering the future of libraries and hearing all of the things that are going on, for example, at the University of Rochester with Nora Dimmick. She's the Assistant Dean for Information Technology, Research, and Digital Scholarship at the University of Rochester's River Campus Libraries. We've covered the digitization of libraries, the adaptation of the skill sets necessary, the way IT comes into it, the jobs that will still be there, and even the way publishing companies have been adjusting to some of these changes. And what we're learning is that libraries are still very much an important part of our communities. But our friend Bill wants to ask two questions about fiction writing. So he says, first of all, do libraries still have fiction sections?
Humongous. Of course.
I figured.
Of course. We still have literature departments. We still have English departments. In fact, we have a medieval library in Rushree's library. The Robbins Library has one of the biggest collections of medieval books in the world. And it also has an online project. But
actual books?
Actual books.
Again, forgive my ignorance. Actual books from the period?
Yes. Yes, some extraordinary, extraordinary books.
But again, you have to be very careful with handling those materials. Are probably pretty fragile, I imagine.
Some
I can't
are.
Walk in off the street and pick up a medieval book.
It might be in a glass case. Or you might be able to come in, though, and use some special gloves and, you know, a pencil. We only allow pencils. But you might be able to come in and actually handle some really extraordinary, rare materials.
Bill's other question about fiction is why. And Bill's been prodding me to do a fiction roundtable in that he's somebody who reads voraciously but says he never reads fiction because fiction is a waste of time, that there's too much learning to go on in the world, that there's so much to be gained from reading biographies and nonfiction that he views fiction as a waste of time. I'm not endorsing his viewpoint by any means, to state the obvious. But he's been telling me, you should do a show called In Defense of Fiction. He wants to hear the argument for why we still need fiction when there's so much to be learned outside of it. So, I know, again, I preface that Bill is a curmudgeon. Do you read fiction, Nora?
Of course I read fiction. What's the latest thing I've read?
What is the latest? Yeah.
That's a tough one. I'd have to get back to you on that because I've been reading a lot of library science.
I was going to say, you probably got a stack of nonfiction. But what is, let's honor that question. And
okay.
maybe we'll do a fiction, In Defense of Fiction roundtable in the future. That we'll have some fun with authors and we'll do that. But from your point of view, the value of fiction, what do you think, Nora?
I think fiction enriches our lives in a way that all really good literature does. I mean, I think when you say fiction, I think, what's my favorite book, right? To Kill a Mockingbird. I'll never forget that book. I mean, I think I reread it about every 5 years. But it brings, and really good fiction brings something to our lives in a way that any art does. It enriches our lives in ways that are hard to describe. But you know it does. It changes you. It You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't read a lot of fiction, but I read some. I have to take it on great recommendation because I read a lot of biography and nonfiction. I'm often reading for the show, and so that covers a lot of that territory. But occasionally we do fiction on the show. One of the best books I've ever read, I read last year, is called The Debt to Pleasure. And I can't even really describe it other than it is a first-person narrative of a homicidal maniac who is posing as a cookbook author-to-be, who is following a couple throughout the English and then French countryside, and you don't fully know why, and you learn as you go. And it is the, I would say, most unique. Unique cannot be modified. It is truly unique, and that kind of writing, I thought, made me not only enjoy it beautifully, it was great art, but I think that great writing makes us better writers, mm-hmm. makes us smarter, mm-hmm. Even if it's fiction, I guess.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, I don't know if I'm making sense in defending fiction that way, but to me, it was absolutely worth every moment I spent reading it, just for the raw pleasure, and then what I would hope would make me somewhat more well-rounded as a human being or a writer, I guess. Am I rationalizing?
I think you're right. I mean, we can learn about other cultures in a way that you can't really learn from you could from a biography, but beautiful writing, really good fiction writing, is storytelling, and it's part of our DNA, I think. I think that there's been storytelling from the start of time, and I just, you know, I think it speaks to our humanness in the way that all art does.
Well, again, the book's called The Debt to Pleasure. You will not regret it if you want to pick it. It's very strange. And and trust me when I tell you, it's one of those books that most of the time when I'm reading a book, if I'm not really in it 30 or 40 pages in, I give up just because I feel like I always have a stack of books I know I'm not even going to get to. Mm-hmm. So why waste time on a book that I'm not in? You've got to tough out the first 50 pages of that book, which will puzzle you. And then it will become this avalanche of pleasure throughout there. So just trust me on that.
Okay.
But don't you feel, I feel The New Yorker is basically published to remind me of all the great writing I'll never have time to read. how do you divide your time on deciding what to read? Isn't that almost to me, it can be frustrating because I always have a stack that I haven't even gotten to.
Oh, yeah.
And you must do because you work around stacks
of
books.
I do. It's terrible. In my office, I have a big pile on my table, and I look at it, and I think, oh, I want to read that. But, you know, I mean, you just pick up, and I learn to read pieces of things, which is why I can't remember the last fiction book I read, which is going to really haunt me now, Evan.
Now you've been on the spot here. You're going to go back, and you're going to pick up fiction this weekend.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to be reading all weekend. I'm going to be under that tree with my fiction book, physical book.
How often do you read, though, for pleasure? Even if I say for pleasure, you're always reading for work, but how often do you have time to read what would be outside of the confines of your work?
Oh, I think, you know, I mean, I like to take the train. If I'm going to New York, I'll take the train. I can work, but then I can also read. I like to read, you know, The Atlantic. I like to read a lot of short pieces now because I can digest them. I like short stories. How often? I read everything. I mean, my kids, are your kids, they read the cereal box? Anything that's on the table?
My boy is just starting to read, yes.
Yeah, right. So we get the newspaper every day. My kids, where's the newspaper? They read all, you know. So there's just kind of this ingrained literacy.
Yeah. I found on a recent vacation that I brought two books, and it was this. I actually told my wife, I said, we're off for a week. I'm going to read for pleasure that has nothing to do with connections. And by the way, one of the great pleasures of the show is all the reading I get to do. But I said, here's the stack of books. It's not related to the show. I'm going to get to it. And I just found, being the parent of a toddler, I ended up with essentially no time to read during the day. When my son would go down at night, I would sit down with a long-form article because that's really what I had time to digest and absorb. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a little bit of that frustration as a parent of a toddler that I'm not reading as much as I'd like. But I think that's also important. And I know the libraries play a role there in offering all kinds of different materials. So we'll close with this thought here. You talk about sort of the renovation and the way you transition, whether it's Rush Reese or libraries in general. The space within a library has if someone hasn't been in a library for 20 years and they walked into the University of Rochester's campuses, how would the space have changed to them?
Well, a lot of it would look very familiar. There's some really beautiful spaces. There's our periodical reading room. There's our Hawkins Carlson and Wells Brown room with the great big club chairs with the bookcases all around. But then there's also Digital Humanities Center, where they're going to walk in and they're going to see Professor Slaughter in there with graduate students and undergraduate students. There's a copy stand. There's someone in there digitizing. They're going to walk through Rare Books. But in the back of Rare Books, they're going to be doing digitizing. They're going to be transcribing letters.
Do you see that I could talk about literature all day?
Yes,
I do. Nora, I'm really glad you took the time to share what's going on at the University of Rochester with us. And it's really buoyed my feeling about the future of not just libraries, but I've got a son growing up. I want him to have great writing and access to these materials, and I know that you're still doing it. So thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break and come back. The second hour, we're talking about one of the only school budgets that did not pass in our area. The consequences of that next hour. Stay with us.